this is certainly the patient where intubation will result in a clean kill.
One of the concerns that we really need to embrace here is not to make the patient worse.
There's a lot of other problems that we have to be on the lookout for.
The key is to not really be intimidated by the procedure.
Don't get all kooky and crazy just driving, trying to control rate.
This makes us all very, very diaphoretic. Greetings and welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, and I am joined with my stellar co-host, Dr. Peter W. from LSU, Dr. Rob Rodriguez from UCSF, and Dr. John Greenwood from Penn in Philadelphia. Gentlemen, how are you this month?
Doing great. Just loving the warm weather.
Likewise, doing very well.
Yeah, absolutely. Keeping busy up here in Philadelphia.
Yes, we've talked a lot as we begin each podcast here about the weather in our specific regions, and I'm so happy that we are making the turn towards warmer weather for sure. I think I've had about enough of the cold and especially the wind here in the Mid-Atlantic. I don't remember ever having a season where it's just been so, so windy. Well, speaking of wind, winds of change, as many of you have encountered over the past several weeks here on our podcast, about 2.5 weeks, maybe 3 weeks ago now, we had our main site crash and we lost all of our audio files that we've actually been able to recover, but it did result in us needing to move over to a new platform, a new domain name. Now, if you still type in www.ccpem.com, it forwards you automatically to the new domain, but it is in essence www.criticalcareinem.com. Please take a look at the website. Obviously, if you're listening to this, you're on the new website. Let us know what you think in terms of how it visually looks and also features that you'd like to add, because there is a lot more functionality with this new platform. We are very excited about this opportunity here, and we're confident that's going to provide you with an outstanding experience. Well, let's get to our educational topic this month. I'm going to turn things over to John, who's going to lead us through a very important discussion on aortic syndromes. John, take it away.
Well, thanks, Mike. And I think as we get started, we've all encountered, and this is one of the bread and butter topics of emergency medicine critical care, is acute aortic disease, particularly when we think of things like acute aortic dissection, and then subsets of this problem. And it's something that we need to be on our toes to recognize and recognize the severity of, even if it doesn't say specifically acute aortic dissection in that CT scan read, as someone comes in complaining of something like chest pain, back pain, or one of those other chest pain plus another symptom above or below the diaphragm. So when we talk about acute aortic syndrome, it's important that we remember that we're talking about three specific diseases. And those three things are obviously dissection, but also things like an intramural hematoma. So this is bleeding within the aortic wall itself, or something called a penetrating atherosclerotic ulcer, also known as a PAU. These are kind of diverticula of the aorta. And while certainly some patients may be asymptomatic with them, whether or not you're symptomatic or not, they have a high risk of rapidly progressing to either dissection or rupture. So it's important that we're ready to act when we see this on our CT scan in terms of providing medical therapy and, depending on the location, surgical intervention if needed. And certainly in any symptomatic patient, treating this just like an aortic dissection with aggressive medical therapy. And so what medical therapy are we talking about? Well, I think in general, the acute resuscitation goals are to minimize the aortic, what we call DP over DT, DPDT therapy, which is, talk about the delta pressure, the DP. It's basically drop the blood pressure, drop the systolic pressure. And this is essentially decreasing the steepness of the rise in the aortic pulse pressure that creates more of a laminar blood flow in the aorta to reduce the shear stress on the injured aortic wall. And in general, our goal is to reduce the systemic pressure as low as possible without compromising visceral perfusion. And in some ways, this might even be analogous to the concept of damage control resuscitation in the trauma patient. You want that pressure to be just low enough where everything's being perfused, but not allowing it to get any higher to cause additional injury. And I think the general target for this would be a systolic blood pressure less than 120 millimeters of mercury. Now, when we get to the DT side, or the change in time, this is largely talking about heart rate control. So this reduces the frequency of the contractile force of the heart pushing blood through the aorta and reducing the patient's heart rate to somewhere between 60 to 70 beats per minute. Now, ideally, we can reach these targets without any complication, and the patient moves rapidly either to ICU or the OR. But there are some times along the way when either the patient doesn't behave how they're supposed to, and there are definitely some technical factors that need to be considered as we're trying to achieve these goals. So as we think about what we're going to do to accomplish these two major resuscitation targets, Peter, why don't you walk us through at least one of the first things that I think all of us are thinking about, which is how do we deliver these drugs, particularly with vascular access and monitoring?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think one of the concerns that we really need to embrace here is not to make the patient worse. And so in that light, we need to understand that for vascular access, that we don't need invasive vascular access. It's not required. We can accomplish our goals really with venous IVs, all simple peripheral IVs, and you really just typically need two. Three would be great, but you really just need two. From an arterial access standpoint, you may ask yourself, since we're really trying to tightly control not just heart rate, but also blood pressure, an art line would be a great thing. And then the question is, okay, now where do I place this? We know that many of these patients, anywhere between 20 to 30% of these patients have pulse deficits, right? When we compare right and left radial pulses, we can see that in 20 to 30% of the cases of type A dissections. We want to make sure that we place our arterial lines in the limb with the highest blood pressure. That's going to be our goal to monitor. We don't want to monitor and shoot targets towards the lowest pulse amplitude or pressure. We want it towards the highest. And I think that that's an important understanding that's really critical. So again, just to remind you, we're going to place the art line in the highest limb with the blood pressure. We need to remember that subclavian branch vessel dissections can really cause reduced limb blood flow, which can give us the sense that the patient has hypotension, what's also known as pseudo-hypotension, because it's really just due to the dissection. This can actually lead to under-resuscitation and inadequate hemodynamic control. So again, as I said, if we use those diminished pulses and diminished pressures as our target, we're going to under-resuscitate the patient. Again, if you feel comfortable, you can use your CT scan to delineate the pathway of the false lumen and give you a better projection where that's going. If really you're unsure, you're going to use the arm with the highest blood pressure to titrate your vasoactive agents. And I think that's a pretty big pearl there.
Excellent point, Peter. So just to summarize, don't waste your time with placing a central line. You know, all your medications can be given through peripheral IVs, and then target the arm with the highest blood pressure. Is that right?
Correct.
So now that we have obtained vascular access, at least for medication delivery and blood pressure monitoring, Mike, why don't you walk us through what's your initial approach and that sort of thing?
Well, thanks, John. I want to reiterate the pearl that you just mentioned, because it frequently comes up when you're at the bedside of a patient, you know, which IV side or which side you put the IV in, and you've really given some clarity there. You know, I'll be honest, I think many of us reach for heart rate control first before we provide afterload reduction. But in terms of that, a second pearl, don't forget about your analgesics. You know, these patients, we've all seen them. We've all seen them writhing around on the bed, and very much they can look like nephrolithiasis. In these patients, provide them with some analgesics. Don't forget the pain medicine, because if we can reduce their pain, that can, in some patients, in many patients actually, reduce their intrinsic sympathetic response. So it certainly helps to decrease that pulse amplitude, that wave that you started off this conversation with. And in some cases, by decreasing that intrinsic sympathetic response, you may be able to get away with using less of the vasoactives, especially in someone who's got much more labile blood pressures. So analgesics first for me. You know, I'll be honest, I start off with fentanyl. I am having to, let's say, mitigate some of the national shortages and issues these last few months with respect to fentanyl. But in general, that's my personal go-to in terms of analgesics. And then I go into heart rate control. And the two medications most commonly used to control heart rate or reduce heart rate to that target 60 to 70 you talked about are labetalol and esmolol. Now, importantly, there is no head-to-head evidence saying that one is any better. And I would say go with whichever one you're most comfortable with, what you're used to from a clinical practice habit standpoint and are very familiar with dosing. I'll be honest, and it's my personal opinion, I'm much more in the Esmolol camp than the Labetalol camp. I've struggled to get proper heart rate and in some cases afterload reduction using Labetalol. But let's touch on that for just a second. Remember, Labetalol has both alpha and beta blockade. You give a loading dose of about 20 milligrams intravenously, and then you can start an infusion at about 0.5 milligrams per minute, and then simply increase by 1 milligram per minute up to about 8 milligrams per minute. Now, this is a little bit simpler approach. Having said that, if you get into trouble and you need to cut off the infusion, it does have a much longer half-life than Esmolol. Now, with respect to Esmolol, that's, remember, pure beta blockade, specifically beta 1 blockade, so we're really drilling down on heart rate control only. The patients, you'd administer a 500 microgram per kilogram bolus intravenously over a few minutes, followed by an infusion of 50 micrograms per kilogram per minute. And then you'd increase by 50 micrograms per kilogram per minute every few minutes based upon patient's clinical response to that. What I like about it is it does have a short half-life, lasts only a few minutes. So if you get into trouble, the patient gets into trouble, you can turn it off and it will have a much shorter duration of action than Labetalol. But sometimes it can be a little bit more challenging to dose. So analgesics first, heart rate control. My personal opinion, once again, I'm using Esmolol, but certainly Labetalol is within current guidelines.
Excellent points, Mike. I think the first pearl about aggressive pain control is definitely important. And the second one you brought up about Esmolol being, you know, that it truly is primarily a negative chronotrope more than everything else. Every now and then we'll get patients transferred and they'll be on Esmolol, their heart rate will be fine, but it's a great reminder that Esmolol, it's not really an antihypertensive, but it really is an effective rate control agent. So great review there. But let's flip to the other side. So, Rob, talk to us a little bit about how you're going to achieve that DP goal, that systolic arterial blood pressure reduction goal. What do you use?
Okay, thanks, John and Peter and Mike. When we're talking about blood pressure control, there are a couple things to remember. Again, you really should start with that heart rate control. And while I'm not saying that you can't necessarily start antihypertensive medications in conjunction or at the same time with the beta blockade, you certainly want to be aware that if you start the antihypertensive treatment before adequate blockade, you can get reflex tachycardia, which is not a good thing. So one principle to remember is that you want to be pretty confident that your beta blockade is on board and it is adequate. So when we're talking about agents to use, there are principally two agents. Those two agents are nicardipine and nitroprusside. Nicardipine is a relatively newer agent. It's a pure alpha blockade arterial vasodilator. It works very fast, pretty rapid onset, pretty rapid offset. And it's really become the drug of choice over nitroprusside, mainly because of the side effects that are associated with nitroprusside. The dosing for nicardipine is 2.5 milligrams per hour IV. You start with about 2.5 milligrams per hour, and you titrate it up pretty rapidly until you achieve your desired effect, with the maximum dose being about 15 milligrams per hour. Remember, again, that you can get reflex tachycardia if you don't have adequate beta blockade. And also be aware that patients who have concurrent heart failure in the setting of aortic insufficiency in this case, that these patients can wind up having some pulmonary shunting and hypoxemia with this agent because they lose their pulmonary hypoxic vasoconstriction. So be aware of that limitation. With regard to nitroprusside, this was the agent that we used to use up in the 80s and even early 90s, but it's generally no longer recommended now that we have nicardipine. The issues with nitroprusside are that it's literally poison. It's converted into toxic metabolites, and these can accumulate, particularly in patients who have liver dysfunction. Additionally, with nitroprusside, which is again, a very potent arterial vasodilator, the effects can be unpredictable and can also cause some other issues like coronary steel and excessive reflex tachycardia. There may be a slight niche role for the use of nitric prusside in dissection associated with cocaine or methamphetamine toxicity, but that's debatable. One other agent that has occasionally been used and might be considered in patients who have renal insufficiency or renal failure is phenoldipam. That, again, is a rapid-acting arterial vasodilator. We don't have as much experience with this, but it can be considered when you're also having the patient with renal failure.
Great, great points, Rob. And I think that the one pearl about the pulmonary shunting is definitely something that's great take home for me. The next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the complications that can arise with aortic dissection. But, you know, as you see that patient, you know they're critically ill. You start seeing that sat start to drop. At least in the beginning, if you have a sense that maybe it's the drug's effect and not necessarily a mechanical problem, you might watch it a little while longer and some of that anxiety might be attenuated. But it is a great lead-in to, well, what about that patient that doesn't behave exactly how you'd like them to? Clearly, with initiating beta blocker therapy, a little bit of alpha blockade as well, we've hopefully gotten them to that sweet spot of a systolic less than 120 heart rate, 60 to 70. But there's a lot of other problems that we have to be on the lookout for, particularly malperfusion syndromes, as well as some valvular insufficiency issues. So Peter, talk to us about the patient who, let's just say you started them on Esmolol and hope to get their heart rate down. They came in with a tachycardia 130, 140, and you're just titrating up and that heart rate's not dropping. And over the course of that first 15 minutes, then they start getting a little bit more hypoxic. What are some things that are running through your head?
So that's a great question. One of the things, John, that we want to think about, if the patient, despite all the Esmolol, is still profoundly tachycardic, is to consider one of the complications of dissection, which is aortic insufficiency. And we should really be thinking about this. The trigger for this should be refractory tachycardia in these patients. Now, the cause of this, there's a myriad of causes. It can be everything from just dilation of the aortic root to malcoaptation of the leaflets of the aortic valve. It can be due to detachment or a tear of one of the aortic valve leaflets. It can also be caused by crazy intussusception of an intimal flap into the left ventricular outflow tract. But, you know, things like water hammer pulses, pistol shots, those kind of things are some of the physical exam findings that we can, you know, talk about. But really, what you want to look for is this persistent tachycardia. And in these cases, we want to make sure that we make a priority to treating the blood pressure over rate control. Don't get all kooky and crazy just driving, trying to control rate and ignoring the systolic blood pressure, particularly in these cases. So aggressive rate control can often dramatically reduce the cardiac output and significantly increase aortic regurgitation. It can worsen or cause abject pulmonary edema, and it can lead to hypoxemic respiratory failure. So there's a whole host of things that it can lead to if we just make the focus rate control as opposed to making blood pressure control the primary in those patients with aortic insufficiency.
Great point, Peter. I think sometimes we do get so narrow focused in achieving these goals that we oftentimes forget about some of these things that aren't as common in a pretty uncommon disease to start with. Now, in terms of one of the other complications is that hypotensive patient. So the patient that comes in, obviously diagnosed a dissection, but over the course of their short time with you as you're trying to get them packaged up, ready to go to the OR, that pressure starts to drop. You no longer need any nicardipine, and it's starting to make you feel uncomfortable. Like, when's the OR going to be ready? Mike, talk to us a little bit about this patient. What are one or two major things that are back in your mind in that patient who's developing hypotension with an acute dissection?
Yeah, this makes us all very, very diaphoretic. And I think one of the key points to start off is that when these patients die and they crash, many times it's actually due to a pericardial effusion, so a retrograde dissection causing a pericardial effusion with resultant tamponade. Now, many of us instinctively reach for the laryngoscope blade, now the video laryngoscope, when patients are heading downhill, get them intubated, put them on positive pressure ventilation, start other resuscitation treatments concomitantly. But in this patient, this is certainly the patient where intubation will result in a clean kill. And early in the setting of tamponade, as that fluid is building up, these patients are very dependent on that negative transpleural pressure to maintain cardiac filling and cardiac output. And as we've all experienced, even outside of the setting of dissection, that peri-intubation cardiac arrest, where the analgesics, the sedatives we give, the positive pressure ventilation that we institute reduces venous return, and quickly many of these patients, especially here with this dissection and resultant pericardial effusion, they're going to suffer hemodynamic collapse and code. And so right off the bat, we're giving them fluids in an attempt to improve their cardiac filling that may help to temporize pressures enough to get them to the OR for the definitive therapy. But let's just say the OR isn't ready, or for whatever reason there's a delay and that patient continues to go downhill despite you providing fluid therapy. Well, now comes the time when you've got to ask yourself, should we do a pericardiocentesis? There's fluid there, there's a tamponade effect, but will this simply release a pressure head and the patient completely exsanguinate and die? And there certainly is that theoretical or that risk. And so recently there's been this term CPD, or controlled pericardial drainage. Really, the literature is limited just to some case series, some retrospective cohorts, where in essence, it's been described where patients are put in a prone position. The skin is provided with a local anesthetic and then a very small, or say an 8 French pigtail catheter, using ultrasound guidance, is inserted into the pericardium with then a controlled drainage. So taking off 5 or 10 cc's at a time, ensuring that the blood pressure bumps or rebounds a little bit, and doing that ever so little to maintain, say, systolic pressures around 80 to 90 to get that patient to the operating room. One series of a little bit less than 20 patients showed that actually it did help decrease mortality by having this controlled pericardial drainage. But I think you're doing this in concert with your CT or your CS surgeons as the preparations are made to get that patient out of the ED and up to the operating room.
I think that's helpful, Mike, and I think that does provide a little bit of support for at least doing something and not sitting on your hands. Again, it's one of these infrequent procedures, but targeting a blood pressure goal with your drainage might help temporize this really, really sick patient. And certainly the use of ultrasound has definitely helped in my practice, and I'm sure many others, particularly with doing the pericardial drainage.
I've actually had the fortune or misfortune of having two of these cases within the past 4 or 5 months, both of whom in which we performed this controlled pericardiocentesis, and I'm sold. It was very impressive in terms of sort of temporizing patients' hemodynamics. In both cases, patients' blood pressures were plummeting into the 60s and 70s, and we did, just as the Hayashi approach recommends, that a controlled pericardiocentesis. The one tip that I would recommend with that is to use a three-way stopcock valve so that you can kind of measure how much you're pulling out into one bag and withdraw. For us, it took more than 5 to 10 cc's. It was often between 20 to 30 cc's at least at a time. And every time we pulled that fluid out, the patient's hypotension resolved with pressures in the 90s to 100 range, and really was very impressive physiology, and I highly recommend it.
That's great, Rob.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's some heroic stuff, Rob. Certainly something that, you know, we can all look up to and, you know, at least have in our back pocket when this eventually, I'm sure, will arise over the course of our careers.
I think the key is, obviously, you're doing this in conjunction with getting the OR ready and with the cardiothoracic surgery team. But the key is to not really be intimidated by the procedure. And first time we did it, we were all kind of, wow, you know, I'm not sure I want to be putting a needle into this area. What if I make things worse? And once we used ultrasound and kind of got over that concern, it went very smoothly and was not difficult at all.
So, Rob, let's stick with you then and wrap this segment up. We've been spending a lot of time directing towards complications from type A dissections. And I think a lot of us, as we make that diagnosis of a type B that maybe doesn't have any visceral malperfusion or renal malperfusion that might need to go straight to the OR, I think many of us, and depending on where you work, might not even have access to a cardiac or a vascular surgeon and might think, oh, well, this is just medical disease. I'll just transfer them to ICU and move them along. Has there been any evidence recently that maybe this isn't the case, that we should be reaching out to our vascular colleagues fairly quickly and maybe thinking about transfer in certain circumstances?
Yes, that is a definite pitfall. That pitfall being that the belief that all type B dissections are purely a medical disease. There has been a recent trial, the INSTEAD XL trial, which showed much improved outcomes with a combined medical management surgical approach to type B dissections, where we've all been taught to reflexively distribute or push patients towards medical management purely for type B disease, but this trial suggests otherwise. And basically, it was a randomized controlled trial of medical management versus medical management plus elective thoracic endovascular aortic repair, or TAVR. And the combined approach showed improved all-cause mortality at 2 and 5 years with dramatic improvements, 4.1 versus 28.1%. The combined approach also showed reduced progression of dissection and reduced false lumen thromboses with the elective TAVR and medical management approach. So our recommendation would be, therefore, to always involve the cardiothoracic surgeons and at least discuss the case with them. And if you're at a center where you don't have the availability of endovascular repair, consider transferring them to another center once you've medically stabilized them.
So thanks, Rob. And that's the INSTEAD XL trial. And I believe that was by Niedenbar. And that was a follow-up study to the INSTEAD trial that came out a few years before that. So we've covered a lot of ground here, a lot of great pearls. So in conclusion, Mike, Rob, Peter, any final takeaways?
Yeah, one of the things that I would say, since we talked about this pericardial syntesis during tamponade, you know, sometimes it can be hard to find a pigtail catheter. In our institution, we've just used central line kits and used those, again, in case of emergency. It would be ideal to have the pigtail. However, should you not have the luxury of time or equipment, just consider central line guided with ultrasound as well. It can save a life.
Absolutely. No point in putting a needle on there if you can put a drain. Mike.
Yeah, I love those points that we've talked about thus far, what Peter just mentioned from a central line standpoint. Forget those analgesics that when we talked about rate control along with afterload reduction. And then just be very, very careful, just simply reflexively reaching for that laryngoscope blade when these patients start to go downhill, because they can quickly crash as soon as you go to perform RSI. And thinking about that controlled pericardial drainage.
Rob?
Yeah, I like all those points. I think that the point that I'd like to make is also be aware of the other complications that are associated with aortic dissection. You can dissect off any of the branches off the aorta, and be aware of the subclinical presentations of aortic dissection in this regard.
Awesome. Well, I think this was a great discussion, guys, and really appreciate you walking through this with great detail. And I mean, there's definitely a lot of technical things that go into managing these patients in addition to just kind of the usual goals. But I thought this was a really nice review. You guys did a great job, so thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks, John, for leading us through this discussion. We're going to wrap this podcast up. But once again, please let us know your thoughts on the new website, any new features that you'd like to see as we continue to grow and advance the podcast. On behalf of John, Peter, Rob, and myself, this is Mike Winters once again, University of Maryland School of Medicine. We will talk to you on our next CCPEM podcast. Bye for now.